The squid reached atmosphere before the three ouster assault boats reached the squid. The boats undoubtedly were armed and well within range, but someone on the command circuit must have been curious. Or furious. Cassad's squid was in no way aerodynamic. As with most ship-to-ship craft, the squid could flirt with planetary atmospheres, but was doomed if it dove too deeply into the gravity well. Cassad saw the telltale red glow of re-entry, heard the ion buildup on the active radio channels, and suddenly wondered if this had been such a good idea. Atmospheric drag stabilized the squid, and Cassad felt the first tentative tug of gravity as he searched the console and the command chair arms for the control circuit he prayed would be there. A static-filled video screen showed one of the dropships growing a blue plasma tail as it decelerated. The illusion created was similar to that encountered when one skydiver watched another open his chute or deactivate his suspension rig. The assault boat seemed to climb suddenly. Cassad had other things to worry about. There seemed to be no obvious bailout control, no ejection apparatus. Every Force Space shuttle carried some sort of atmospheric egress device. It was a custom dating back almost 8 centuries to when the entire realm of spaceflight consisted only of tentative excursions just above the skin of old Earth's atmosphere. A ship-to-ship shuttle probably would never need a planetary bailout device, but age-old fears written into ancient regulations tended to die hard. Or so the theory went. Cassad could find nothing. The ship was quaking now, spinning, and beginning to heat up in earnest. Cassad slapped open his harness release and pulled himself toward the rear of the squid, not even sure what he was looking for. Suspension packs? Parachutes? A set of wings? There was nothing in the troop carrier section except the corpse of the ouster pilot and a few storage compartments not much larger than lunchboxes. Cassad tore through them, finding nothing bigger than a medkit. No miracle devices. Cassad could hear the squid shaking and beginning to break up as he hung on a pivot ring and all but accepted the fact that the ousters had not wasted money or space on such low-probability rescue devices for their squids. Why should they? Their lifetimes were spent in the darkness between star systems. Their concept of an atmosphere was the 8-click pressurized tube of a can city. The external audio sensors on Cassad's bubble helmet began to pick up the raging hiss of air on the hull and through the broken blister in the aft section. Cassad shrugged. He had gambled too many times and lost. The squid shuddered and bounced. Cassad could hear the manipulator tentacles tearing away from the bow. The ouster's corpse suddenly was sucked up and out of the broken blister like an ant into a vacuum cleaner. Cassad clung to the pivot ring and stared through the open hatch at the control seats in the cockpit. It struck him that they were wonderfully archaic, like something out of a textbook of the earliest spacecraft. Parts of the ship's exterior were burning away now, roaring past the observation blisters like goblets of lava. Cassad closed his eyes and tried to remember lectures from Olympus Command School on the structure and layout of ancient space-going craft. The squid began a terminal tumble. The noise was incredible. "By Allah!" gasped Cassad, a cry he had not uttered since childhood. He began pulling himself forward into the cockpit, bracing himself on the open hatch, finding handholds on the deck as if he were climbing a vertical wall. He was climbing a wall. The squid had spun, stabilized in a stern first death dive. Cassad climbed under a 3G load, knowing that a single slip would break every bone in his body. Behind him, atmospheric hiss turned to a scream and then to a dragon roar. The troop carrier section was burning through in fierce, molten explosions. Climbing into the command seat was like negotiating a rock overhang with the weight of two other climbers swinging from his back. The clumsy gauntlets made his grip on the headrest even less sure as Cassad hung over the vertical drop to the flaming cauldron of the carrier section. The ship lurched. Cassad swung his legs up, and he was in the command seat. The display videos were dead. Flame heated the overhead blister to a sick red. Kassad almost lost consciousness as he bent forward, his fingers feeling in the darkness below the command seat, between his knees. There was nothing. Wait! A hand grip! No. Sweet Christ and Allah! A D-ring! Something out of the history books. The squid began to break up. Overhead, the blister burned through and spattered liquid perspex throughout the interior of the cockpit, splashing Kassad's suit and visor. He smelled plastic melting. The squid was spinning as it broke up. Kassad's sight turned pink, dimmed, was gone. He used numb fingers to tighten the harness. Tighter. Either it was cutting into his chest, or the perspex had burned through. His hand went back to the D-ring, fingers too clumsy to close around it. No. Pull! Too late. The squid flew apart in a final screech and explosion of flame, the control console tearing through the cockpit in 10,000 shrapnel-sized bits. Kassad was slammed into his seat. Up, out, into the heart of the flame. Tumbling. Kassad was dimly aware that the seat was projecting its own containment field as it tumbled. Flame was centimeters from his face. Pyro bolts fired, kicking the ejection seat out of the squid's blazing slipstream. The command seat made its own track of blue flame across the sky. Microprocessors spun the seat so that the disk of the force field was between Kassad and the furnace of friction. A giant sat on Kassad's chest as he decelerated across 2,000 kilometers of sky at 8 gravities. Kassad forced his eyelids to open once, noted that he lay curled in the belly of a long column of blue-white flame, and then he closed his eyes again. He saw no sign of a control for a parachute, suspension pack, or any other braking device. It didn't matter. He could not move his arms or hands in any case. The giant shifted, grew heavier. Kassad realized that part of his helmet bubble had melted or been blown away. The noise was indescribable. It didn't matter. He closed his eyes more tightly. It was a good time to take a nap. Kassad opened his eyes and saw the dark shape of a woman bending over him. For a second, he thought it was her. He looked again and realized that it was her. She touched his cheek with cool fingers. "Am I dead?" whispered Kassad, raising his own hand to grip her wrist.
"No."
Her voice was soft and throaty, blurred with the hint of an accent he could not place. He had never heard her speak before.
"You're real?" "Yes."
Kassad sighed and looked around. He lay naked under a thin robe on some sort of couch or platform set in the middle of a dark, cavernous room. Overhead, starlight was visible through a broken roof. Kassad raised his other hand to touch her shoulder. Her hair was a dark nimbus above him. She wore a loose, thin gown which, even in the starlight, allowed him to see the outlines of her body. He caught her scent, the fragrant hint of soap and skin and her that he knew so well from their other times together.
"You must have questions,"
she whispered as Kassad released the gold clasp which held her gown in place. The gown whispered to the floor. She wore nothing underneath. Above them, the band of the Milky Way was clearly visible. "No," said Kassad, and pulled her to him. Toward morning, a breeze arose, but Kassad pulled the light cover over them. The thin material seemed to preserve all of their body heat, and they lay together in perfect warmth. Somewhere, sand or snow rasped at bare walls. The stars were very clear and very bright. They awoke at the first hint of dawn, their faces close together under the silken coverlet. She ran her hand down Kassad's side, finding old and recent scars.
Your name?
Whispered Kassad.
Hush,
she whispered back, her hand sliding lower. Kassad moved his face into the scented curve of her neck. Her breasts were soft against him. Night paled to morning. Somewhere, sand or snow blew against bare walls. They made love, slept, made love again. In full light, they rose and dressed. She had laid out underwear, gray tunic, and trousers for Kassad. They fit perfectly, as did the sponge socks and soft boots. The woman wore a similar outfit of navy blue.
Your name?
Kassad asked, as they left the building with the shattered dome and walked through a dead city.
Moneta,
said his dream.
Or Nemosyne, whichever name pleases you more.
Moneta, whispered Kassad. He looked up at a small sun rising into a lapis sky.
This is Hyperion?
Yes.
How did I land? Suspensor field? Parachute?
You descended under a wing of gold foil.
I don't hurt. There were no wounds?
They were tended to.
What is this place?
The city of poets, abandoned more than 100 years ago. Beyond that hill lie the time tombs.
The ouster assault boats that were following me.
One landed nearby. The Pain Lord took the crew unto himself. The other two set down some distance away.
Who is the Pain Lord?
Come,
said Moneta. The dead city ended in desert. Fine sand slid across white marble, half buried in dunes. To the west, an ouster dropship sat with its portals irised open. Nearby, on a fallen column, a therm cube yielded hot coffee and fresh-baked rolls. They ate and drank in silence. Kassad worked to recall the legends of Hyperion.
The Pain Lord is the Shrike, he said at last.
Of course.
You're from here? From the City of Poets?
Moneta smiled and slowly shook her head. Kassad finished his coffee and set the cup down. The feeling that he was in a dream persisted, much stronger than during any sim he had ever participated in. But the coffee had tasted pleasantly bitter. The sun was warm on his face and hands.
Come, Kassad,
said Moneta. They crossed expanses of cold sand. Kassad found himself glancing skyward, knowing that the ouster torch ship could lance them from orbit. Then knowing, with a sudden certainty, that it would not. The time tombs lay in a valley. A low obelisk glowed softly. A stone sphinx seemed to absorb the light. A complex structure of twisted pylons threw shadows onto itself. Other tombs were silhouettes against the rising sun. Each of the tombs had a door, and each door was open. Kassad knew that they had been open when the first explorers discovered the tombs, and that the structures were empty. More than 3 centuries of searching for hidden rooms, tombs, vaults, and passageways had been fruitless.
This is as far as you can go,
Moneta said, as they neared the cliff at the head of the valley.
The time tides are strong today.
Kassad's tactical implant was silent. He had no comm log. He searched his memory.
There are anti-entropic force fields around the time tombs, he said.
Yes.
The tombs are ancient. The anti-entropic fields keep them from aging.
No,
said Moneta.
The time tides drive the tombs backward through time.
Backward through time, Kassad repeated stupidly.
Look.
Shimmering, mirage-like, a tree of steel thorns appeared out of the haze,
and a sudden dust storm of ochre sand. The thing seemed to fill the valley, rising at least 200 meters to the height of the cliffs. Branches shifted, dissolved, and reformed like elements of a poorly tuned hologram. Sunlight danced on 5-meter-long thorns. Corpses of ouster men and women, all naked, were impaled on at least a score of these thorns. Other branches held other bodies. Not all were human. The dust storm obscured the view for a moment, and when the wind subsided, the vision was gone.
Come, said Moneta.
Kassad followed her through the fringes of the time tides, avoiding the ebb and flow of the anti-entropic field the way children would play tag with an ocean surf on a broad beach. Kassad felt the pull of the time tides like waves of deja vu tugging at every cell of his body. Just beyond the entrance to the valley, where hills opened to the dunes and low moors led to the city of poets, Moneta touched a wall of blue slate and an entrance opened to a long, low room set into the cliff face.
Is this where you live?
Asked Kassad, but saw immediately that there were no signs of habitation. The stone walls of the room were inset with shelves and crowded niches.
We must ready ourselves,
whispered Moneta, and the lighting shifted to a golden hue. A long rack lowered its wares, a wafer-thin strip of reflective polymer curtained from the ceiling to serve as a mirror. Kassad watched with the calm passivity of a dreamer, as Moneta stripped off her clothes and then his. Their nudity was no longer erotic, merely ceremonial.
You have been in my dreams for years, he told her.
Yes, your past, my future. The shockwave of events moves across time like ripples on a pond.
Kassad blinked as she raised a gold ferrule and touched his chest. He felt a slight shock, and his flesh became a mirror, his head and face a featureless ovoid reflecting all the color tones and textures of the room. A second later, Moneta joined him, her body becoming a cascade of reflections, water over quicksilver over chrome. Kassad saw his own reflecting reflection in every curve and muscle of her body. Moneta's breasts caught and bent the light. Her nipples rose like small splashes on a mirrored pond. Kassad moved to embrace her and felt their surfaces flow together like magnetized fluid. Under the connected fields, his flesh touched hers.
Your enemies await beyond the city,
she whispered. The chrome of her face flowed with light. Enemies.
The ousters. The ones who followed you here.
Kassad shook his head, saw the reflection do likewise.
They're not important anymore.
Oh, yes,
whispered Moneta.
The enemy is always important. You must arm yourself.
With what?
But even as he spoke, Kassad realized that she was touching him with a bronze sphere, a dull blue toroid. His altered body spoke to him now as clearly as troops reporting in on an implant command circuit. Kassad felt the bloodlust build in him with turgid strength.
Come.
Moneta led the way into an open desert again. The sunlight seemed polarized and heavy. Kassad felt that they were gliding across the dunes, flowing like liquid through the white marble streets of the dead city. Near the west end of town, near the shattered remnants of a structure still bearing the inscribed lintel of Poets' Amphitheater, something stood waiting. For a second, Kassad thought it was another person wearing the chromium force fields he and Moneta were draped in. But only for a second. There was nothing human about this particular quicksilver over chrome construct. Kassad dreamily noted the four arms, retractable finger blades, the profusion of thorn spikes on throat, forehead, wrists, knees, and body, But not once did his gaze leave the 2,000 faceted eyes, which burned with a red flame that paled sunlight and dimmed the day to blood shadows. The Shrike, thought Kassad.
The Lord of Pain,
whispered Moneta. The thing turned and led them out of the dead city. Kassad approved of the way the ousters had prepared their defenses. The two assault boats were grounded less than half a kilometer apart, their guns, projectors, and missile turrets covering each other and a full 160 degrees of fire. Ouster ground troops had been busy digging revetments 100 meters out from the boats, and Kassad could see at least 2 EM tanks hull down, their projection arrays and launch tubes commanding the wide, empty moor between the poet's city and the boats. Kassad's vision had been altered. He could see the overlapping ship containment fields as ribbons of yellow haze, the motion sensors and anti-personnel mines as eggs of pulsing red light. He blinked, realizing that something was wrong with the image. Then it came to him. Besides the thickness of the light and his enhanced perception of energy fields, nothing was moving. The ouster troops, even those set in attitudes of motion, were as stiff as the toy soldiers he had played with as a boy in the Tharsis slums. The EM tanks were dug into their hull-down positions, but Kassad noticed that now even their acquisition radars, visible to him as concentric purple arcs, were motionless. He glanced skyward and saw some sort of large bird hanging in the sky, as unmoving as an insect frozen in amber. He passed a cloud of wind-blown dust hanging suspended, extended one chrome hand, and flicked spirals of particles to the ground. Ahead of them, the Shrike strode casually through the red maze of sensor mines, stepped over the blue lines of trip beams, ducked under the violet pulses of the autofire scanners, passed through the yellow containment field and the green wall of the sonic defense perimeter, and walked into the assault boat's shadow. Moneta and Kassad followed. How is this possible? Kassad realized that he had posed the question through a medium that was something less than telepathy, but something far more sophisticated than implant conduction.
He controls time.
The Pain Lord?
Of course.
Why are we here? Moneta gestured toward the motionless ousters.
They are your enemies.
Kassad felt that he was finally awaking from a long dream. This was real. The ouster trooper's eyes, unblinking behind his helmet, were real. The ouster assault boat, rising like a bronze tombstone to his left, was real. Fedmon Kassad realized that he could kill them all, commandos, assault boat crew, all of them, and they could do nothing about it. He knew that time had not stopped, any more than it stopped while a ship was under Hawking Drive. It was merely a matter of varying rates. The bird frozen above them would complete the flap of its wing given enough minutes or hours. The ouster in front of him would close his eyes in a blink if Kassad had the patience to watch long enough. Meanwhile, Kassad and Moneta and the Shrike could kill all of them without the ousters realizing that they were under attack. It was not fair, Kassad realized. It was wrong. It was the ultimate violation of the new Bushido. Worse in its way than the wanton murder of civilians. The essence of honor lay in the moment of combat between equals. He was about to communicate this to Moneta when she said, thought,
Watch.
Time began again with an explosion of sound not unlike the rush of air into an airlock. The bird soared and circled overhead. A desert breeze threw dust against the static-charged containment field. An ouster commando rose from one knee, saw the Shrike and the two human shapes, screamed something over his tactical comm channel, and raised his energy weapon. The Shrike did not seem to move. To Kassad, it merely ceased being here and appeared there. The ouster commando emitted a second, shorter scream, and then looked down in disbelief as the shrike's arm withdrew with the man's heart in its bladed fist. The ouster stared, opened his mouth as if to speak, and collapsed. Kassad turned to his right and found himself face to face with an armored ouster. The commando ponderously lifted a weapon. Kassad swung his arm, felt the chrome force field hum, and saw the flat of his hand cut through body armor, helmet, and neck. The ouster's head rolled in the dust. Kassad leaped into a low trench and saw several troopers begin to turn. Time was still out of joint. The enemy moved in extreme slow motion 1 second, jerked like a damaged hollow to 4/5 speed in the next instant. They were never as quick as Kassad. Gone were his thoughts of the new Bushido. These were the barbarians who had tried to kill him. He broke one man's back, stepped aside, jabbed rigid, chrome fingers through the body armor of a second man, crushed the larynx of a third, dodged a knife blade moving in slow motion, and kicked the spine out of the knife wielder. He leaped up out of the ditch.
Kassad!
Kassad ducked as the laser beam crept past his shoulder, burning its way through the air like a slow fuse of ruby light. Kassad smelled ozone as it crackled past.
Impossible! I've dodged a laser!
He picked up a stone and flung it at the ouster manning the tank-mounted hellwhip. A sonic boom cracked. The gunner exploded backward. Kassad pulled a plasma grenade from a corpse's bandolier, leaped to the tank hatch, was 30 meters away before the explosion geysered flame as high as the assault boat's bow. Kassad paused in the eye of the storm to see Moneta in the center of her own circle of carnage. Blood splashed her, but did not adhere, flowing like oil on water across the rainbow curves of chin, shoulder, breast, and belly. She looked at him across the battlefield, and Kassad felt a renewed surge of bloodlust in himself. Behind her, the shrike moved slowly through the chaos, choosing victims as if he were harvesting. Kassad watched the creature wink in and out of existence, and realized that to the Lord of Pain, he and Moneta would appear to be moving as slowly as the ousters did to Kassad. Time jumped, moved to 4/5 speed. The surviving troops were panicking now, firing into one another, deserting their posts, and fighting to get aboard the assault boat. Kassad tried to realize what the past minute or two had been like for them. Blurs moving through their defensive positions, comrades dying in great gouts of blood. Kassad watched Moneta moving through their ranks, killing at her leisure. To his amazement, he discovered that he had some control of time. Blink, and his opponents slowed to 1/3 speed. Blink, and events moved at nearly their normal pace. Kassad's sense of honor and sanity called out for him to stop the slaughter, but his almost sexual bloodlust overpowered any objections. Someone in the assault boat had sealed the airlock, and now a terrified commando used a shaped plasma charge to blow the portal open. The mob pressed in, trampling the wounded in their flight from unseen killers. Kassad followed them in. The phrase, "fight like a cornered rat," is an extremely apt description. Throughout the history of military encounters, human combatants have been known to fight at their fiercest when challenged in enclosed places where flight is not an option. Whether in the passageways of La Haye Sainte and Hougoumont at Waterloo, or in the hive tunnels of Lussis, some of the most terrible hand-to-hand battles in history have been fought in cramped spaces where no retreat is possible. It was true this day. The ousters fought and died like cornered rats. The shrike had disabled the assault boat. Moneta remained outside to kill the 60 commandos who had stayed at their posts. Kassad killed those within. In the end, the final assault boat fired on its doomed counterpart. Kassad was outside by then, and he watched the particle beams and high-intensity lasers creep toward him. followed an eternity later by missiles which seemed to move so slowly that he could have written his name on them in flight. By that time, all of the ousters were dead in and around the overrun boat, but its containment field held. Energy dispersion and impact explosions tossed corpses around on the outer perimeter, set fire to equipment, and glazed the sand to glass. But Kassad and Moneta watched from inside a dome of orange flame as the remaining assault boat retreated to space.
"Can we stop them?"
Kassad was panting, pouring sweat, and literally quivering from excitement.
"We could," replied Moneta. "But we do not want to. They will carry the message to the swarm."
"What message?"
"Come here, Kassad."
He turned at the sound of her voice. The reflective force field was gone. Moneta's flesh was oiled with sweat. Her dark hair was matted against her temples. Her nipples were hard.
"Come here."
Kassad glanced down at himself. His own force field was gone. He had willed it away, and he was more sexually excited than he could ever remember being.
"Come here,"
Moneta whispered this time. Kassad went to her, lifted her, felt the sweat-slick smoothness of her buttocks as he carried her to an empty stretch of grass atop a wind-carved hummock. He lowered her to the ground between piles of ouster bodies, roughly opened her legs, took both her hands in the grasp of one of his, lifted her arms above her head, pinned them to the ground, and lowered his long body between her legs.
"Yes,"
whispered Moneta as he kissed the lobe of her left ear, set his lips to the pulse at the hollow of her neck, licked the salt-tang sweat from her breasts. Lying among the dead, more dead to come, the thousands, the millions, laughter out of dead bellies, the long lines of troops emerging from jump ships to enter the waiting flames.
"Yes."
Her breath was hot in his ear. She freed her hands, slid them along Kassad's damp shoulders, trailed long nails down his back, grasped his buttocks to pull him closer. Kassad's erection scraped her pubic hair, throbbed against the cusp of her belly. Farcaster portals opening to admit the cold lengths of attack carriers, the warmth of plasma explosions, hundreds of ships, thousands dancing and dying like dust motes in a whirlwind. Great columns of solid ruby light lancing across great distances, bathing targets in the ultimate surge of warmth. Bodies boiling in red light.
"Yes."
Moneta opened her mouth and body to him. Warmth above and below, her tongue in his mouth as he entered her, welcomed by warm friction. His body strained deep, pulled back slightly, allowed the moist warmth to engulf him further as they began to move together. Heat on 100 worlds, continents burning in bright spasms, the roll of boiling seas, the air itself aflame, oceans of superheated air swelling like warm skin rising to a lover's touch.
"Yes, yes, yes."
Moneta breathes warm against his lips. Her skin is oil and velvet. Kassad thrusts quickly now, the universe contracting as sensation expands, senses dwindling as she closes warm and wet and tight around him. Her hips thrust harshly in response now, as if sensing the terrible build in pressure at the base of his being. Demanding. Kassad grimaces, closes his eyes, sees fireballs expanding, stars dying, suns exploding in great pulses of flame. Star systems perishing in an ecstasy of destruction. He feels pain in his chest, his hips not stopping, moving faster, even as he opens his eyes and sees the great thorn of steel rising from between Moneta's breasts, almost impaling him as he unconsciously pulls up and back, the thorn blade drawing blood which drips on her flesh, her pale flesh, reflective now, flesh as cold as dead metal. His hips still moving, even as he watches through passion-dimmed eyes, as Moneta's lips wither and curl back, revealing rows of steel blades where teeth had been. Metal blades slash at his buttocks where fingers had gripped. Legs, like powerful steel bands, imprison his pumping hips. Her eyes. In the last seconds before orgasm, Kassad tries to pull away, his hands on her throat, pressing. She clings like a leech, a lamprey ready to drain him. They roll against dead bodies. Her eyes like red jewels, blazing with a mad heat like that which fills his aching testicles, expanding like a flame, spilling over. Kassad slams both hands against the soil, lifts himself away from her, from it. His strength insane, but not enough, as terrible gravities press them together. Sucking like a lamprey's mouth as he threatens to explode, looks in her eyes. The death of worlds. The death of worlds. Kassad screams and pulls away. Strips of his flesh rip away as he lunges up and sideways. Metal teeth click shut in a steel vagina, missing his glands by a moist millimeter. Kassad slumps on his side, rolls away, hips moving, unable to stop his ejaculation. Semen explodes in streams, falls on the curled fist of a corpse. Kassad moans, rolls again, curls in a fetal position, even as he comes again and again. He hears the hiss and rustle as she rises behind him. Kassad rolls on his back and squints up against the sunlight and his own pain. She stands above him, legs apart, a silhouette of thorns. Kassad wipes sweat from his eyes, sees his wrist come away red with blood, and waits for the killing blow. His skin contracts in anticipation of the slash of blade into flesh. Panting, Kassad looks up to see Moneta above him, thighs flesh rather than steel, her groin matted from the moisture of their passion. Her face is dark, the sun behind her, but he sees red flames dying in the multifaceted pits of her eyes. She smiles, and he sees sunlight glint on rows of metal teeth. "Kassad," she whispers, and it is the sound of sand scraping against bone. Kassad tears his gaze away, struggles to his feet, and stumbles across corpses and burning rubble in his terror to be free. He does not look back. Scouting elements of Hyperion's self-defense force found Colonel Fedmon Kassad almost 2 days later. He was discovered lying unconscious on one of the grassy moors which led to the abandoned Kronos Keep, some 20 kilometers from the dead city and the wreckage of the ouster ejection pod. Kassad was naked and almost dead from the effects of exposure and several serious wounds. But he responded well to emergency field treatment and was immediately airlifted south of the Bridal Range to a hospital at Keats. Reconnaissance squads from the SDF battalion moved northward carefully, cautious of the anti-entropic tides around the time tombs and wary of any booby traps left behind by the ousters. There were none. The scouts found only the wreckage of Kassad's escape mechanism and the burned-out hulks of the two assault boats which the ousters had lanced from orbit. There were no clues as to why they had slagged their own ships, and the ouster bodies, both in and around the boats, had been burned beyond any hope of autopsy or analysis. Kassad regained consciousness 3 Hyperion days later, swore that he remembered nothing after stealing the squid, and was shipped out on a force torch ship 2 local weeks later. Upon returning to the web, Kassad resigned his commission. For a while, he was active in anti-war movements, occasionally appearing on the All Thing Net, arguing disarmament. But the attack on Brescia had mobilized the hegemony toward true interstellar war, as had nothing else in 3 centuries. And Kassad's voice was either drowned out or dismissed as the guilty conscience of the butcher of South Brescia. In the 16 years after Brescia, Colonel Cassad had disappeared from the web and from the web consciousness. Although there had been no more major battles, the ousters remained the hegemony's prime boogeymen. Fedmon Cassad was only a fading memory.
It was late morning when Cassad finished his story. The consul blinked and looked around him, noticing the ship and its surroundings for the first time in more than 2 hours. The Benares had come out into the main channel of the Huli. The consul could hear the creaks of the chains and hawsers as the river mantas surged against their harnesses. The Benares appeared to be the only ship heading upriver, but now numerous small craft were visible going the other way. The consul rubbed his forehead and was surprised to see his hand come away slick with sweat. The day had grown very warm, and the shadow of the tarp had crept away from the consul without his noticing. He blinked, wiped sweat from his eyes, and moved into the shade to get a drink from one of the liquor bottles the androids had set in a cabinet near the table. "My God," Father Hoyt was saying. "So, according to this Moneta creature, the time tombs are moving backward in time?"
"Yes,"
said Cassad. "Is that possible?" asked Hoyt.
"Yes."
It was Saul Weintraub who answered.
"If that's true, then you met this Moneta, or whatever her real name is, in her past, but your future, in a meeting that's still to come."
"Yes,"
said Cassad. Martin Silenus walked to the railing and spat into the river.
"Colonel, do you think the bitch was the Shrike?"
"I don't know."
Cassad's monotone was barely audible. Silenus turned to Saul Weintraub.
"You're a scholar. Is there anything in the Shrike mythography that says the thing can change shape?"
"No,"
said Weintraub. He was preparing a milk globe to feed his daughter. The infant made soft, mewling noises and moved tiny fingers.
"Colonel,"
said Het Mastin,
"the force field, whatever the fighting suit was, did you bring it with you after the encounter with the ousters and this female?"
Cassad looked at the Templar a moment and then shook his head. The consul was staring into his drink, but his head suddenly snapped upright with the force of a thought.
"Colonel, you said that you saw a vision of the Shrike's killing tree. The structure, the thing where it impales its victims."
Cassad moved his basilisk stare from the Templar to the consul. He slowly nodded.
"And there were bodies on it?"
Another nod. The consul wiped sweat from his upper lip.
"If the tree is traveling backward in time with the time tombs, then the victims are from our future."
Cassad said nothing. The others also were staring at the consul now, but only Weintraub appeared to understand what the comment meant, and what the consul's next question had to be. The consul resisted the urge to wipe the sweat from his lip again. His voice was steady.
"Did you see any of us there?"
Cassad said nothing for more than a minute. The soft sounds of the river and the ship's rigging suddenly seemed very loud. Finally, Cassad took a breath.
"Yes."
Silence stretched again. Braun Lamia broke it.
"Will you tell us who?"
"No."
Cassad rose and went to the stairway leading to the lower decks. "Wait," called Father Hoyt. Cassad paused at the head of the stairway. "Will you at least tell us two other things?"
"What?"
Father Hoyt grimaced from a wave of pain. His gaunt face went white under its film of perspiration. He took a breath and said, "First, do you think the Shrike, the woman, somehow wants to use you to start this terrible interstellar war you foresaw.
Yes.
Second, will you tell us what you plan to petition the Shrike for, or this Moneta, when you meet them on the pilgrimage? Kassad smiled for the first time. It was a thin smile, and very, very cold.
I will make no petition. I will ask nothing of them. When I meet them this time, I will kill them.
The other pilgrims did not speak or look at one another as Kassad went below. The Benares continued north-northeast into afternoon.